On the war in Syria, the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, in a meeting with the Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, warned that Saudi Arabia's political and religious ideology is, quote, a threat to the world. Has Saudi Arabia's support for terrorists reached such an alarming level? So much so that even the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, in his visit to Iraq, has said that he will discuss Saudi's support for terrorism with UN members. On this edition of the debate, we'll discuss how isolated Saudi Arabia and its policy in Syria have become. Turkey, that has long called for the ouster of President Bashar al-Assad, in addition, is now calling for a shift in government policy towards Syria. We'll also discuss how the U.S. has come to recognize that their support for these insurgents has backfired, and further analyze reports of Western intelligence agencies wanting to cooperate with Syria, Iran, and Russia in battling these extremists.
As fighting continues between foreign-backed insurgents and government forces across Syria, diplomatic efforts are in full swing as the Geneva II conference, which is aimed at ending the conflict, draws closer. Iran, along with Russia and China, has been in favor of a diplomatic resolution of the conflict and is now playing a key role on the diplomatic scene. Tehran, however, has not been invited to the conference under pressure from the U.S. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has met with the Syrian president in Damascus to discuss with Bashar al-Assad ways of ending the crisis.
Ahead of the Geneva II conference, the Islamic Republic of Iran deems it necessary to hold talks with major regional countries, Syria included, to make arrangements for the adoption of constructive and effective stances to restore peace and stability to this sensitive region and to confront extremism and sectarianism and find ways to put an end to the catastrophic situation in Syria, which has highly dangerous human, political and global dimensions.
Many observers have come to believe that the recent developments on the ground prove there is no military solution to the unrest in Syria, and that supporters of regime change in the country through militarizing the situation have already failed. Turkey, that has long called for the ouster of President Bashar al-Assad, is now calling for a shift in government policy towards Syria. Turkish President Abdullah Gül said Tuesday he believed that Ankara should recalibrate its diplomacy and security policies given the facts in Syria. Turkey has been a major supporter of the insurgency against the Syrian government, but the flow into Syria of arms and extremist militants that are mainly paid by the Saudi petrol dollars still continue. The Syrian president, during his meeting with the Iranian foreign minister, strongly condemned the Saudi regime for its negative role not only in Syria but the entire world.
The Syrian people and some people in the region know how serious the threat posed by Wahhabism is, and everyone must contribute to the confrontation against it and to eradicating it from the root.
Assad described Wahhabism, which is Saudi Arabia's official ideology, as a worldwide threat. Riyadh's key ally, the U.S., and other Western players in the region seem to be relinquishing their support for the efforts to topple Bashar al-Assad at the hands of al-Qaeda-linked groups. They are said to have concluded that Assad's opponents cannot be banked on as a genuine alternative to him. The recent fierce infighting amongst the foreign-backed insurgents in Syria has further fostered the notion in Western capitals that the militants are too divided to serve their interests. The facts on the ground are also showing another aspect to this dilemma. The insurgents show no sign of being the winners in this war, and the Syrian president has weathered the worst of it all.
Lots of ground to cover in this edition of the debate on the war on Syria. Let me introduce our guest, journalist and Middle East analyst Sharif Anashashibi, joins us from London. And we have author and historian Webster Griffin Tripoli, who joins us from Washington. Gentlemen, welcome. I need to get your reaction first, Webster Griffin Tripoli, on what the Syrian president has said about Saudi Arabia. And this was in a meeting with the Iranian foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif. He's warned that Saudi Arabia's political and religious ideology is a threat to the world.
Well, I think there's ample evidence that that is exactly correct. The nature of the conflict in Syria from the very beginning has been primarily a foreign influx of foreign fighters, terrorists and adventurers from around the world. But none of this would have been possible without the funding from the Saudi Arabian government. And in particular, the adventurous, reckless policy of Prince Bandar, who is now leading the intelligence establishment there, seems to reflect a certain desperation. If we just look at the last couple of weeks, what seems to have happened is that the Saudi leadership, led by Bandar, have decided that they're defeated within the framework of Syria. That is to say, their terrorists, the death squads that they had been fostering there, the Wahhabites and other extremists, are simply militarily incapable of overthrowing Assad, and also incapable of holding their own. We're constantly on the verge of the liberation of Aleppo from these forces, so that the Saudis have said, well, if we can't win within the framework of Syria alone, we'll escalate, we'll include Lebanon. That's been going on for some months. But then they also seem to say, let's also escalate inside Iraq. So they have activated the assets that they've kept in Iraq over a long time. And at the same time, remember the famous visit of Bandar to Moscow, which was marked by a threat from Bandar to Putin, which was, in effect, stop supporting Syria, or we, Saudi Arabia, will foster terrorism in conjunction with the Winter Olympics that are now coming up next month in Sochi. So we've had these attacks in Pyatigorsk and the two lethal attacks in Volgograd, Stalingrad, of course. And that would seem to be the threat being made good on. So from the expansion of Syria to include Iraq and Lebanon, one prong, and then the other one, what the Saudis seem to be doing, encouraging Doku Umarov and the other Chechen terrorists, it looks like they're in a very dangerous flight forward. So I think Assad is quite correct.
Not to mention some of the other countries that perhaps Saudi Arabia is involved with, Sharif Nashashibi. I mean, Saudi Arabia's ambassador to Britain recently in an op-ed in the New York Times said that Saudi Arabia will go it alone. You know, Saudi Arabia's coming out with statements like nothing is ruled out in our pursuit of peace in our world, or when they said they act independently by rejecting a seat on the UN. What is Saudi Arabia gaining by creating such, how can you say, mayhem in the region? I mean, their support for these al-Qaeda insurgents obviously gives somewhat, not somewhat, but a large platform for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to make that statement.
Look, that's a very loaded question, and unfortunately, what I've become used to on this program is having to discuss the issue of foreign involvement, but looking at only half the picture. We have to look at the whole picture in Syria, and I have said for a long time that foreign involvement in Syria in general has been very damaging for the country and the people in general, and for ensuring that the conflict has been prolonged. You cannot just look at Saudi involvement or U.S. involvement. You have to look at the foreign involvement in its entirety, including the involvement in support of Bashar Assad, of Iran, of Russia, of Hezbollah, of Iraq. There are elements on both sides that are involved in the conflict. You must look at the whole picture. And to talk about Lebanon and Iraq simply as if whatever the troubles are in those countries is because of Saudi involvement is completely ignoring the policies of Hezbollah, which have inflated the insecurity in Lebanon, and the policies of the Iraqi government against their own population, against the Sunni population. We can't simply pretend that this doesn't exist and that this wouldn't happen unless Saudi Arabia felt a certain way about it. I'm not a Saudi spokesman, but you know, if you're, the other guest is a historian, we have to look at it historically, not believe in conspiracy theories that everything in the Middle East is solely down to the involvement of Saudi Arabia or the US or certain actors. There are domestic policies in each of these countries which are exacerbating the security situations in those countries. We can't look at it simply in one very narrow aspect.
Webster Griffin Tarpley, reaction.
Well, it's certainly true that there are, you know, long-standing problems in Lebanon and especially in Iraq. What I was trying to suggest is that the very dramatic flare-up, the seizure of Ramadi and Fallujah in the last couple of weeks, seems to reflect this decision by the Saudis to unleash their minions and start something which was not going on before. And it seems to reflect this strategic desperation. So that is certainly true. I also think you have to draw, under international law, a very clear distinction between governments that are invited to support Syria by the duly constituted government, right? Syria, UN member state, sovereign state, existing nation, widely recognized for many decades. They have the right to ask foreign states or others to send in assistance, but that's quite different from Saudi Arabia saying, look, we've got a bunch of Chechen terrorists, let's send them across the border and create mayhem. Those are not to be put on the same plane. So there is no equality between those two.
Sharif, necessarily, go ahead.
Hold on, I'm sorry. If we're going to bring up international law, no government in the world, let's be clear about this, whether they're sovereign or not, no government in the world has the international legal right to commit crimes against humanity or war crimes against its own people. And there has been ample evidence documented by the UN and internationally respected human rights groups that the Syrian regime has committed war crimes and crimes against humanity. The opposition have also committed crimes, but we're talking here about your alleged, you know, the alleged right of the Syrian government to invite other governments to support it. No government is allowed to commit those abuses against its own people, and no government is allowed to get other support from other countries to commit those abuses. There is nothing in international law that says that that is a right of any government in the world, be it Syria or the US or Israel or any other country. I'm sorry, this is just not the case.
Sharif Nashashibi, with all due respect, the landscape in Syria.
I would have to point out. I would just like to point out that under the UN Charter and under natural law since time immemorial, every state has the inalienable right to self-defense. So if we find that Saudi Arabia and Qatar are killing Syrians, they are killing their own people.
This is not self-defense. This is a dictator crushing opposition against his dictatorial rule. This is not self-defense. No, I'm sorry. This is the realm of fantasy we're in now. I'm sorry.
Well, that's what we've been hearing for so many months. But I think the court of world history is going the other direction. Let me just point out two important statements here from Washington, which I think show a qualitative shift in the mentality. First, we have Ryan Crocker, ambassador to Pakistan, to Iraq, and other countries. He's a distinguished former diplomat. He's the head of the Bush School of Foreign Affairs at Texas A&M University. And his opinion as of December is that Assad is the least worst. Ungrammatical, I guess that's the modern State Department, but you get the idea. He's saying that Assad is the lesser evil, which I think is the basis for any rational discussion. Then we've also got General Michael Hayden, the former head of the CIA, saying something similar, that in Syria you can choose between endless civil war and endless radicalization, or the breakup of the country, or Assad. And he points out that Assad is the most acceptable of those three alternatives. So here we have the State Department old boys and the CIA Air Force old boys essentially agreeing that the bet on these death squads is a failure, that it hasn't worked. It's a loser. And if you follow Saudi Arabia down that road, then whoever does that is going to be in tremendous trouble.
Sharif Nashashibi,
You're bringing up these examples as if to try and state that they are agreeing with your stance. That's not the case. Those officials, whatever they may think, and I don't necessarily agree with their views, but they don't think that Bashar Assad is a good guy or a good option. You, however, I haven't seen anything from you, any criticism about a dictator who has committed horrific crimes against his own people. You haven't said anything about him. I mean, you seem to think he's a really nice guy. So you cannot raise them as examples of backing up your view because you think that he is a wonderful option. They don't. They think he's a bad option, but there are other bad options. I don't see any of that kind of sentiment coming from you.
Webster Griffin Tarpley?
All I said is that this is the lesser evil. The future of civilization in some place like Syria is not going to be served by having rebels who have engaged in cannibalism and massacres, for whom beheading seems to be a common practice. One of the reasons that the rebels of the more extreme type, the Islamic Emirate of Iraq and the Levant, they're having trouble holding on to the areas that they've been able to grab, because simply the populations are absolutely fed up with this benighted, brutal, failed administration that they're being subjected to. This is one of the dangers of a ceasefire. The call for a ceasefire is being raised, and it's meant in goodwill. But a ceasefire could not be interpreted as saying this will freeze certain areas under the control of these madmen, because then you're condemning those populations to what? To being beheaded, having their hands lopped off, or whatever it is. The Democratic opposition in Syria has long since rejoined Assad.
Well, let me get this from you. Sharif Nashashibi, I'd like to keep current with what's going on. The statements you have made, with all due respect, they could have applied maybe months ago. But at this point, whether right or wrong, we're looking at a landscape that has changed in many different ways. And one of the biggest ones has been the shift away from the United States, from Saudi Arabia. And we could see that even in Turkey, supporter of obviously the ouster of Assad, the President Abdullah Gül, came out recently and said on Tuesday, actually, that I am of the opinion that we should recalibrate our diplomacy and security policies, given the facts that in the south of the country, in Syria. Now, there's been obviously this shift away from what it appears from Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia being at the forefront right now. Some saying it's circumvented not only the U.S., but other countries who are in support. Of course, Saudi Arabia, along with Qatar, being the countries that are still supporting these insurgents, which has created this alarm. Don't you agree with that right now it's Saudi Arabia that's fueling the flames of violence inside Syria?
I think there are many actors fueling the flames inside Syria. My problem with being on the show is that there is only a focus on one particular party causing problems in
what
Syria.
What focus would you like to have?
And that's not the case. It's a wider
problem.
Name a country
you'd like to put a focus
and
on.
My point... Oh, well, there are so many countries that have a stake inside Syria, that are involved inside Syria. We have to look at all of them. But this program seems to only want to focus on only one side or one party.
Well, let's not do that. Let's focus on one of the countries that are of importance that you'd like to focus on. If you'd like, we could take Iran as an example.
Okay, Bashar Assad would not be in the position he's in today. His longevity would not be assured without the support of Iran, of Russia, of Hezbollah, of Iraq. These are primary supporters of Bashar Assad. He wouldn't be around today without their support. And yet here we are talking about support for the insurgents or rebels or opposition, whatever you want to call them in Syria. It is an unequivocal fact that the support that these rebels have received pales in comparison to the support that Bashar Assad receives from his supporters. I mean, we're not talking here about heavy weaponry, the kind of weaponry that
Bashar Assad
receives on a daily
basis. Let me get a reaction from Webster Griffin Tarpley. Guest there says it pales in comparison. Do you agree in terms of the support?
I don't think this is the right way to discuss it. I think what you've got to ask yourself is, first of all, you don't want to get involved in an academic discussion about who's worse, who kills more. This doesn't lead you anywhere. The goal is to find
a way out.
What are the structures, institutions, political forces? Because that's a completely abstract and useless, futile exercise. The question is, how can you save civilization in this part of the world? What can you build on? Can you build on the Islamic Emirate of Iraq and the Levant, where beheading and cannibalism are the order of the day, or a very flawed but somewhat stable Syrian government under Assad with an army and other institutions of a modern state? Seems to me it's obviously the latter, so that if you're going to try to get out of this crisis, you've got to rely on those structures. I would say the most useful initiative would be to proclaim the repatriation of foreign fighters. Please go back to Chechnya, to Indonesia, to Libya, to Egypt, to Saudi Arabia, all these other places.
To Lebanon,
those people
to
should
Iran.
Go home. And at that point, Syrians might be able to decide.
Sharif Nashashibi,
this is somewhat different, because these are forces that have been invited by the existing government, which is a United Nations
by
member
a dictatorship
state,
that is committing mass rights. Crimes and abuses. That is not acceptable. I'm sorry. This is a dictatorship that's committing war crimes and crimes against humanity. There is no justification for supporting such a regime. And you seem to think that the only choice Syrians have is between... I'm sorry, please. You spoke, let me speak. You seem to think that Syria's only choice is between this regime or between Islamist extremists. Syrians deserve neither. They deserve better than that. I don't want Islamist extremism or any kind of fanatical extremism in Syria, but a dictatorial regime in Syria is also unacceptable to me. Why should Syrians only have these two options? They deserve better than that. And you seem to think that a dictatorship is okay for Syrians? I'm sorry. We would not be in the situation today if Syria had not been under the rule of the Assad regime for decades.
One of the things
that I would like to stress the most is the need for an economic reconstruction program. This country has now been devastated. It needs an economic reconstruction program that would essentially rebuild the cities, rebuild the infrastructure, rebuild the water systems, hospitals, public buildings, transportation, right? Syria, of course, is located close to that point where Asia and Africa and Europe come together, right? It is in the middle of everything. It could become a tremendous hub of transportation, various kinds of sea, air, and rail transport. It could have a great future. That's what I would like to see. But you're kidding yourself. You're not going to get that with the Islamic Emirate of Iraq and
Sham. We haven't had
Sham.
That with
the
Assad.
Thing I
Assad
would say
has
is,
been tried
in terms of this conference.
Failed.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're going to have to end it there. I'm sorry. I had so many more questions to ask. I do apologize. Let me thank our guest, journalist and Middle East analyst Sharif Nashashibi from London, spoke to us.
Okay.
You were just listening to author and historian Webster Griffin Tarpley from Washington. Thanks for watching another edition of The Debate. Any questions or comments, newsroom@presstv.ir is our email address. From Mikhail Tapwa and the entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.